Welcome to The Property Wizard, brought to you by Creative Insight, helping you connect, and Gentry Learning, real estate professionals and educators. If you are brand new to the real estate investment world or have limited experience, you've come to the right place. Fred Crouch has over 35 years of real estate investing experience. He's seen it all, and he's ready to share it with you. This podcast takes an inside look at investing in real estate, what to look for, and most of all, how to move forward. Please welcome the property wizard, Fred Crouch.
Hi, wizards. Welcome back. Welcome to season 5 of The Property Wizard. A big thank you to the team at Carl Speaks, headed up by no other than Mr. Podcast himself, Carl Richards. We would especially like to acknowledge and thank our producer, Dom Carrillo, and supporting this awesome duo are Nathan Simon, who created the original sound score, and Caroline Nicolai, who every episode supplies us with new cover artwork. Thank you, everyone, for your wonderful effort. Again, so it's been a little while, wizards. Let's start off recapping the previous podcast episode when we discussed real estate fraud. And there were a number of points that were made. Do you have any initial comments or thoughts on that episode, Bernie?
Brendan, it's something that you see it's been prevalent over the last year. People come up with the "it's too good to be true" return on rate, and usually if it is, that's exactly what it is. It's hot air, and it's your money leaving your pocket. Legal advice is always key. Not going to the lawyer before you start putting ink to paper. And title transfer, that's the other thing. We heard that there's like several different ways to transfer your title, and next thing you know, gone.
Yeah, I think we finished up that episode with it was with Mark, correct?
Mark Habib,
wasn't it? That was the second time on the show, I believe. We kind of finished up with half a dozen points, and I'll go over them now. But things that for all our listeners out there, you should really pay heed to. So the first thing that we came up, if it sounds too good to be true, then it probably is. The second thing was do not succumb to high-pressure sales tactics. And that was a really important point, too, because you very often get this. There's always this built-in urgency that someone pitching the idea kind of builds into it. The next point that I want to make, the thing that I'm really, really insistent on, and not all promoters and developers feel the same way, but I'm of the opinion that if you can't see or touch it, then stay away from it. Really, you want to be able to drive by your investment, actually touch the mortar and bricks. You want to see where your money is going. Because so many people, and we touched on it just briefly, we were talking about mortgage fraud, right, Bernie? And one of the things that a lot of people do is they throw their money into these pools that are promoted by individuals that are trying to raise funds for a construction project. And what ends up happening a lot of time, I mean, what the pitcher is saying, it's backed by a mortgage. It's backed on a mortgage on a property. So the investor, particularly if he's a novice investor, is thinking, well, geez, I mean, like, what's the risk? It's secured. It's secured by a mortgage on like real property. The problem is that when those projects, and a lot of them do, fall apart and crumble, what you realize very quickly is yes, absolutely. It's backed by a mortgage on a property. But what they don't realize, it's not a first mortgage. It's not a second mortgage, but it could be a third, fourth, fifth, sixth mortgage. And what's happened is that the promoter has gone out raising funds. And every time a block of funds is created, they secure it. They secure it as a mortgage on a property. Now, without revisiting our entire episode on power of sales, which we're going to do with a future guest in a couple of weeks, if I'm not mistaken, the only thing that differentiates a first mortgage from a second mortgage, from a third mortgage and ad nauseum, is the time at which the lien was registered. That's it. And I'm not going to get into postponement clauses. I'm not going to get into a whole lot of legalese that a lot of our listeners may not appreciate or understand. But at the end of the day, if you register a mortgage at 1 o'clock and there's no other mortgage on the property, that's a first mortgage. If you register another mortgage at 2 o'clock, could be the same day, but it's not a first mortgage. It's a second mortgage. And it keeps on going that way. So if there is a default, guess who has priority over all other charges? Bernie, can you take a guess?
Oh, I think the first person that is owed the money.
Exactly, the first mortgage. If there's any money left over that, then the second mortgage may get a piece of what the realized funds are. So that's very, very important, okay? The fourth point was stay away from unsolicited real estate offers. Like, stay away from them. Like, you need to, at all times, be aware of who is making the offering and where the offering is coming from. So stay away from unsolicited real estate offers. Someone giving you a call on the phone and saying, hey, today's your lucky day. I can guarantee you 16% over the next 6 months. No, no, no. The red flag should be going up and you should head for the door at the absolute minimum. Hang up the phone. The fifth point is read the fine print of any offering. Like, read it. If it's a syndication or a co-tenancy, there's nothing wrong with those forms of investment. But read the fine print. And better yet, particularly if you're a novice investor, have a solicitor or a lawyer review the document. Any syndicator, any manager of a co-tenancy will absolutely, without question, give you a copy of the agreement beforehand, and more importantly, encourage you to go get independent legal advice, or ILA in the business. That's what it's referred to. You'll hear that term tossed around. It just means independent legal advice. It should be encouraged. The points and the contents of the agreement should be discussed. You never know. I mean, the co-tenancy agreement that we use at our firm has gone through a dozen different hands. There have been adjustments made when they were warranted. Everything is up for discussion. But more importantly, at the end of the day, particularly after a length of time, what you have is a highly refined document that will hold up regardless of the situation. So very, very important. The last thing that I'd like to bring to our listeners' attention is that you should know both the person making the offering and the people you're going to be involved with. That doesn't mean that you have to have them over for a 5 o'clock scotch, or in Bernie's case, a 10 o'clock. It doesn't matter. Or even have coffee with them. But know who they are. Usually when we do a co-tenancy or any type of, put a group of investors together, we'll at least have a breakfast or a luncheon just so people can see the other people and toss around ideas. Because you may be involved in this particular venture, but there's nothing stopping one, two, or three of you from branching out and getting involved in another real estate related venture. Because co-tenancies aren't a unit that, well, they can purchase property as the same group over and over again. I've had one in particular that's probably on their fifth or their sixth investment property, but they don't have to be made up of the same folks. So get to know your other investors socially. I'm not saying you have to become their best friends. I'm not suggesting you got to take their dog for a walk, nothing like that, but get to know them. And if you're a syndicator of any credibility, what you're going to want to do is you're going to want to make those social gatherings happen. It's good for cohesiveness. It's good even if you want to discuss a point or something, you know, maybe an opportunity. Very often we'll have or we'll set aside time when we receive, if we have a particular project or a block of land, we'll set aside time to have a meeting, an impromptu meeting, to discuss what everybody wants to do. Do we want to sell this property? Do we want to develop it ourselves? It's also a great opportunity if one of the members of your co-tenancy wants to turn around and step back and say, I'm really good here, but I don't want to do that. That's all okay. There's nothing wrong with that at all. So if you stick to these half a dozen points, I am of the belief that it's going to be very difficult for you to go wrong. Anything for you to add, Bernie, at all?
No, I think at the end of the day, the social aspect is good because you get to know the people. And like you said, it doesn't have to be down to the here, be the godparent of one of my kids. But if you get a sense of who they are, then there's community. That's part one. I think part two is also if there's a deal that's coming up, and maybe it's a sweetheart deal, that's what your lawyer is for. You know, that'll slow things down because the lawyer will take the right time. It's not emotionally driven for the lawyer, right? It's the lawyer will check out the providence and the connections. It's not an absolute. And then you have your accountant. So, you know, does everybody know everybody, even if you don't know them?
Yeah, use your team, right? Well, how many times have we spoken about your team, not just as an individual investor, but as a group? Know your team, have trusted advisors. Don't be afraid to ask questions. And really, who a lot of these questions should be pointed to is it the individual that's managing either the co-tenancy or the syndicator. Don't be afraid to ask questions. And you know there's an issue if all of a sudden they're balking or you're not getting the answer to your hard-asked questions. So that's, at the end of the day, it's really, really important. Be informed. Look, real estate is by far the number one and the best way to create wealth, both individually and, you know, legacy wealth or generational wealth. By all means, I mean, we don't have to revisit. We revisit it every podcast, but it is for sure. But be educated. Turn around and ask the questions and find those members of your team that fill those gaps in knowledge that maybe you don't possess. I've been at this for a long time, and every once in a while, somebody will throw me a curve, and I'm usually pretty good. But if I'm starting to second guess myself or I'm not quite 100% sure, particularly, for instance, when it comes to investing in the U.S., I've got a pretty good knowledge of it, and we've done it. But if there's a very specific question that somebody is asking, I can always reach out to a tax expert, whether domestically or in the States. We can make those connections and make those queries, and that's exactly what you should be doing. So that's a great recap, Bernie. So brilliant. What's next?
Well, I think we have something in the mailbag for you there, Fred. It's Sue from Kelowna. She had to drop you a note to let you know that your podcast episode on real estate fraud was fantastic. And her whole office was listening to it. And have any other real estate fraud related episodes coming up? So anything else coming up in the future about this area?
Yeah, as a matter of fact, first of all, thank you very much for your email, Sue. Our next scheduled podcast will deal with specific examples of real estate fraud and how to recognize that the real estate investment you're being pitched may not be everything you might expect. It'll be an important one out there for all you wizards. I mean, it's very, very important to get a firm handle on this. So thank you for writing in, Sue.
Perfect. And just, folks, if you're listening to this, if you have any questions, send your emails to info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com. And, of course, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
From the current events desk of the Property Wizard, it's news of the week.
Wizards, today I want to talk about conversions. And these were conversions that were first thought of and introduced to the market during the pandemic, when many institutions, government institutions and private institutions, introduced working at home to their employees. Now, fortunately, the pandemic has now since passed us by, knock on wood. And what we're still left with are buildings that are vacant and waiting for some repurposing. So I really wanted to touch base on this. And at this stage, I'd like to introduce Kwesi Bourne. I've known Kwesi for years now. He's a highly respected real estate broker, developer himself, but I think he can add to this conversation. So the title of the article that I'd like to kind of use as our template is Conversions and Show Suites Help Western Canada's Landlords Handle Office Vacancies. The original article was written by Howard Chai with the Business Intelligence for BC publication. It's an online publication. So I was going over a number of different articles, and this one seemed to kind of touch base on a few things. And I thought, okay, because that was kind of all the rage from the investment standpoint. People were looking at buildings to convert. People were primarily looking at larger government-type buildings with floors, complete floors of vacant space that they can convert to residential. Now, we've brought this topic up time and time again over the past several years. And one of the things that I'd always thought about, and I because everyone would come back every time I'd open the mailbag, there'd be a question or a comment having to do with conversions. That's the way everybody's, you know, headed. But I always caution people that not all buildings are built in such a manner that you can easily convert. In a lot of instances, I've maintained that it's cheaper to turn around and take the building down and build from scratch. I know that's incomprehensible to some of our listeners, but to those that are in tune with building costs and what it costs to build, you very quickly come to the realization that you're not going to get these buildings for nothing, number one. Number two, there's a cost to the whatever amount of demolition you're going to have to do, and then there's a cost related to the construction. And it's not necessarily clean, new construction. It's construction based around adapting. It's like a renovation project. And those of us who have been developing and renovating, you come to the same realization that renovation costs are much higher than new construction costs. And why is that? Kwesi, can you answer that question for our listeners? You know why.
When it comes to renovation, it's a lot of your unknown. I think
exactly.
You look at a project, you think it's this, and then all of a sudden, boom, you take down a wall, and then, oh, you have to go into this. And plus, you got to bring it up to new code, right? Like a lot of these old office buildings, they're built a certain way they're like 80s buildings typically. If you want to do it today, anything that's off has to be updated to today's code, you know, so it can just snowball into. What's next? Yeah. It can delay projects. You know, you have to get new permits. I mean, even with the site that we did, if they go through asbestos, I mean, that's the whole thing. So
exactly.
A lot crazy. Of unknown when it comes to renovation.
That's exactly it. The key word is unknown. Like you just don't know what you're getting into. Look, at any architect, any contractor with a modicum of experience can sit down and give you a rough guesstimate as to what it's going to cost to do A, B, C, D, E. I mean, that's what a general contractor does. That's what architects do. That's what even tradespeople, that's what they do. But the problem happens with exactly what Kwesi said when you're dealing with unknown factors. So I'm down in LA a couple of weeks ago. I make some queries. I'm talking to some people that really have a lot of commercial real estate experience. And I pose that question to them. And they throw back at me exactly what we just discussed. Exactly. You know, there's been some starts and stops and talk about different counties giving allowances to builders to renovate some of these buildings, which I thought, okay, genius, great, wonderful. That's a good idea. I came back up to Canada, did a little more research myself, and very quickly realized that it's not so common in central and eastern Canada, but in the western provinces, a lot of municipalities have tried to do just that. Exactly that. What they do is they will supply a builder with a certain amount of money per square foot for the conversion of office space to residential space.
So I've heard of a lot of conversation around the programs, but I can't say I've heard of the details around them. I know that there's a number of buildings that it was last year they had selected a certain amount of buildings within Ottawa that they're specifically looking at for these types of programs in terms of the conversion. I know there's like two big players in town who have really looked at this and really looked at the science around it and are actively looking to do these types of conversions, but I'm not aware that they've finalized on what this program is going to be. Now, that being said, some of the affordable housing initiatives that exist would probably work. So if they're doing a certain amount of affordable housing, I mean, the city's got a program, CMHC's got a program, that would probably work. I have to triple check, but I believe even CMHC might have something around that. There's definitely a way that they can play with CMHC to take advantage when they're doing the conversion.
For sure. Yeah, I'm familiar with that program, and we're going to talk about it more during your Q&A.
Yeah.
So at the end of the day, Not all buildings lend themselves nicely to this type of conversion.
No.
So there was a great big of noise about it, and everybody was looking at it as the next and greatest investment opportunity. But the harsh reality is that not all buildings are suitable for this type of redevelopment.
Yeah.
The other thing that you have to keep in mind is that during this period of time where there's been excess office space, a lot of potential tenants have taken advantage of the fact that there was a vacancy in maybe a Class A building. And again, we don't need to get into Class A, Bs, and Cs. We have done that in previous shows. But essentially, it's called leasing up. So someone who may have leased a fair bit of space in a Class B building or Class C, and again, the difference between Class B and C is very much determined on the location of the building. Yes, Class A buildings are usually the newest. Usually they have built-in concierge services, high-end and high-speed elevators. They may even have, for instance, gyms and restaurants and all sorts of things available to the tenant. But that may be a Class A in a major center, but in a smaller center, a Class A doesn't necessarily have to have those amenities. Again, it's geographic in nature. Yeah. So you could have a small town, and you could have three different buildings, all maybe built 20 years apart. And technically, from a definition standpoint, your newest building would be your Class A, even if it didn't have a high-speed elevator.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter. So it's important to understand that while there's generics, generally speaking, you know, the point that's trying to be made here is someone in a particular geographic area who may have occupied a Class B or C space took advantage of the fact that they can move up or lease up to nicer space with nicer accommodation without a big increase in the amount of rent they were paying, because these landlords who had and owned these Class A buildings, and for the most part, those landlords on those buildings are going to be leased to major institutions, companies, government agencies, and they were the ones that rolled back. They were the ones who sent their employees home.
Yeah.
They were the ones that bought out their leases. So all of a sudden, you're a landlord, you've got this beautiful building, you want to fill it. So what ends up happening is that someone comes by and says, well, I'm such and such, and I'm in, you know, 123 Class B building down the street. I'd love to get some space, but I'm worried about rental rate. Hey, as a owner of a Class A building, I'm going to say, come on down. We'll turn around and we'll make it work for you. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, these landlords were even turning around and doing the leasehold improvements at no additional cost to that tenant. So it was a win-win-win-win situation, not just for the tenant, who has all of a sudden really leased up and has got big, beautiful, bright office space with all the amenities, but also for the landlord, because the landlord was able to turn around a lease space. Maybe his margin wasn't as much. Maybe at the end of the day, his short-term rate of return wasn't as much. But what he's done is that he's created a loyal tenant. So we need to kind of keep that all in mind. So what we're dealing with for these type of conversion projects are Class B and Class C buildings. They're older.
Yeah.
There's no doubt about it. Because they're older, particularly if it was built, as Kwesi, you pointed out, in the 70s, in the 80s, I mean, their floor plates do not lend themselves well at all.
Because
you really essentially need to bring in plumbing and HVAC to each and every individual unit.
You may as well
turn around and start building from scratch. I just want to touch base here on a couple of things before we move on. Calgary, according to our friend Howard Chai, and I'm going to paraphrase this, he says Calgary is ground zero for office conversions, not just in Canada, but across North America, with about 2.7 million square feet of space across 21 office buildings converted or in the process of being converted. I mean, that really says something. Now, what they did, the city of Calgary created conversion incentives, offering $75 per square foot for every office space converted. Now, where's 75% going to get you? I'm going to take an educated guess and say it may account for 25% of the build-out costs. I don't know, Kwesi, whether you'd agree with me or not, but it really depends. I'd say, you know, you got to be looking at easily $300 per square foot, if not more. But then it depends on, you know, what the floor plate you're working with is.
As simple
as that.
But the fact that they even give the incentive, I think,
it
opens the door. It says, let me actually look at this. I mean, I think or else people wouldn't look at it. Because like you said, that unknown factor is such a deterrent for many people. Yeah, it's not just any kind of contractor who can do the office conversion, you know?
Yeah. So another Western Canadian city, Edmonton, is offering $100 per square foot. But there's not a lot of takers for it. There just isn't a lot of takers in Edmonton. And I would kind of suggest that maybe they weren't as hard hit during the pandemic as maybe Calgary was. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, I'm just taking an educated guess. And to many of our listeners that aren't familiar with Canada and the various industries and different territories, it would make sense to you, considering that a lot of people would consider Calgary maybe the economic center of Western Canada. I mean, look, I'm going to get and hear crap from everybody about that. I'm just making a point.
Yeah.
That's, you know, look, Calgary was first off the mark. The program in Edmonton only started in 2023.
Okay.
They're offering more, but there are fewer takers.
If I could just comment quickly, I mean, I think that I think there's a combination of things there. So if Calgary started earlier, that's a good point. The number of buildings in Edmonton, probably less. The fact that, again, when you're converting these, a lot of these people are converting it into rental. Converting into rental in Calgary, too. The other thing about Alberta has no rent control. So for someone who's looking at it as an operator, say, do I want to convert a building or should I just buy some land and build my own? You know, the approvals for building new apartment building in general over there is quite quicker. So it becomes a location thing. I think if the location was sweet and worthwhile, then it's certainly worth going into. But if your building was challenging and the location was subpar, then maybe they just want to build a new piece of land, right?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, not knowing too much about the vintage of some of these office buildings that are being considered. You know, at the end of the day, buildings that were built in the 60s and 70s, they're even more difficult to convert.
Yeah.
So, and those are the ones that inherently are going to suffer the most. You may think, well, there's these office buildings that, you know, that primarily are vacant, you know, and were vacant during the pandemic. But in a lot of instances, they may, but that doesn't mean the rent isn't being paid.
Yeah.
So you have to kind of keep that in mind. And outside of the fact that most of these larger buildings just don't convert well, a lot of the smaller ones are actually, it's kind of comical because in some instances, in older parts of a city, the buildings that are currently commercial were originally built to be residential. So you're talking about low-rise buildings that may have been, you know, maybe they could have been 6, 7, 8-door rows. They could have been high rises, 4 to 6 stories high, and they were eventually converted.
Yeah.
So now we're talking about converting them back. Anyways, I know we could talk this to death. This would be a great topic for its
own
podcast. But, you know, at the same time, you know, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
Very good. There we go. We got
a quick question. If you're building, doing a green build or doing a rebuild, would you build it that you could flip the building either way, go from office to home or residential to home? Or would you design it that way that you could always, if the winds of fortune change again like they have, would you not build the place so that it can be flipped either direction? Or does that be too costly?
No, I would like to think that what we experienced during the pandemic was hopefully a once in a generation type of blimp in the
market. Yeah.
I understand what it is you're saying. Some buildings could lend themselves to that. Absolutely. But to build with that foresight, I don't believe And look, at I'm not the ultimate knowledge bearer in that front, but I don't believe there's really a cost effective basis. I mean, it would be more like, it would be akin to building a single family home and putting an in-law suite in it. That would be an easy conversion.
Yeah.
Not talking about converting the use completely. You're talking about taking a residential unit and making a commercial unit out of that. The first thing and problem that you're going to have is with zoning.
Yeah.
Like zoning, you cannot overlook
zoning. That's true.
In a development project.
Yeah.
You just can't. Just because they say you can build a single family home or a low rise building doesn't mean that it's a foregone conclusion. They're going to let you turn around and convert it to office space X number of years down the road. That's not good. So it's a good question. I just don't see it happening, Bernie. So thank you for the roundtable discussion, everyone. Really some incredible insight. Very much appreciated. And I'm sure our listeners did too. I'd like to introduce to our listeners right now, Kwesi L. Bourne, who is the owner and operator of KLB Investment Realty and Advisory. It's a real estate investment firm that assists real estate investors in the acquisition and sale of commercial and investment real estate. He also works with clients in joint venture opportunities for the purchase and development of commercial property. Right up our alley, listeners. Kwesi is a fully licensed bilingual real estate broker and formerly the broker of record for Sinner Capital. Kwesi has been recognized in the marketplace for the past 10 years. And actually, it's been longer than that now, Kwesi. As a well-connected commercial broker. Although he is well-versed in all aspects of real estate, he is well-respected as a commercial broker across many Ontario markets. Over his career, he's been involved in smaller plex sales under $500,000 to large portfolio sales worth upwards of $20 million. Welcome to the show, Kwesi. Thank you for the invaluable input that you had while discussing our In the News segment. And I look forward to additional insights. Why don't you introduce our guest to his first question of the day?
Well, Fred, thank you so much.
I just didn't want you to fall asleep.
Oh, no, Fred, I'm not falling asleep at all. No, third wheel here, you know. All kidding aside. Kwesi, so for our listeners, what's the most recent project you've been involved with? Like, where are you building? What's the scoop behind it?
So right now we're working on a 20-unit development building. This is in Rockland, Ontario, Clarence Rockland. It's just outside of Ottawa. Yeah, just literally, like, you flip... There's Ottawa on one line, and then you flip over, you're in Clarence Rockland, literally. So that's what we're working on now, is 20-unit building, where we're in the air. It's going to be a three-story building. It's going quite well so far. They're actually, today's Saturday, and there's actually guys working on it right now, finishing the roof. So I'm actually been quite happy with the pace and the guys and the team that we have working on it. Everyone's been working quite well on it.
So... how did you originally identify the property? Did you have an investor come to you? What were you looking for? Like, how did you fall into this?
So how it came, so I'll take you even back further a little bit. So my mom is who actually introduced me to real estate in general. Okay. So she owned, grandma had a saying, like, if you have land, you always eat. So she understood, okay, let me buy an investment property. Over time, she bought one. Then she bought this nice big piece of property on 10th Line Road in Orleans, okay, and with the vision of developing it. Now, anyone who drives by, you would recognize it's a big site. I think that site is around 140 by 220, something like that. It's a fair sized site. So
Okay.
Yeah, exactly. So from that point, I mean, in our mind, okay, I was looking at buying more infill sites. They're going to be worthwhile for development. I mean, I understood that the baby boomer generation was certainly going to be looking for housing and probably downsizing in that type of thing. So when the property came up available, now this was in 2018 that I purchased the property. Okay, so, and we only started construction in 2025. So when that property came available, I knew we could do something with it. I knew what was also unique about it is I knew that the city had also recently changed the zoning specifically for that property. So the town at the time wanted to see infill, and they wanted to see things going, being built, and they wanted to see housing. And this was, again, and at the time, actually, their push, the reason they had done it was because they were actually hoping for a hotel to go there. Now, time happens, time changes, you know, the market changes, the demand changes. They're very happy to see housing go there. You know, to be honest, it's been good. When we put in the application, they were actually hoping we'd build a bigger building, you know, and we looked at that. But the problem was the soil wasn't compatible enough to be able to support underground parking. It would have increased our cost quite a bit on not just the underground parking, like cost, not just the cost of underground parking, but because the water table is higher.
Yeah, that entire area was the site of the Champlain Sea, as most seabeds are in that area.
Yeah.
There's a predominance of what's called Lita clay.
Ah.
Lita clay, when it's saturated by water, is very slippery.
Yeah.
Like very slippery. And it just does not, if you want to build a building of any substance or size in
yeah.
the area, it takes a considerable amount of cost and underpinning to
yeah.
do so that it remains stable. Sorry, just a little bit of a side.
No, that's good.
I know
that's
the
good.
Area
you know,
you're thinking about.
No, it's good. It's an interesting thing too, because so I had my office in that building before, and so that building is probably one of the older buildings in town. So I've heard the stories of from everyone, people who just pass by and walk and say, this building used to be a nail salon. This building, one lady, I remember she posted, she walked by, she's like, yeah, my brother, a long time ago, he had a bakery in the building. You know, there's someone who was like, there used to be a fish place. There's someone who's like, yeah, there used to be an apartment on top, you know? So it was a very interesting thing to see and hear the history on it. Yeah. But to your point about identifying the property, essentially, we was definitely looking at a property that had infill potential that was going to be big enough to build some substance and something that, you know, we could build and hold for a long time and do well on. So that was the biggest criteria here. And the price. I mean, the price was attractive. I was fortunate enough that the seller was actually a developer themselves, but they were going through some internal changes within the family. So they fortunately, I remember too, like it was a little bit lighter than where she actually wanted to be price wise, but you know, she let it go to us. So, you know, we thank them for that.
Oh, brilliant. That's great. So you bought the property in 2018?
Yeah. 2018.
So you spent the next, there was a building on it at the time?
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's where you had your office.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a small office. I rented it. I rented the other side of it. That was another key piece of it too. I wanted to make sure to get a property that had something on it, so it would be financeable on the purchase, so we could pay it down slowly over time. And, you know, when you buy it just as land, it's much more difficult to finance, especially if you're not going to be building right away.
Absolutely.
So that was definitely a criteria for us in terms of what we're looking at it.
I got into a discussion just yesterday with a new client about just that.
Yeah.
About a large parcel of property I have available
for
sale. And we got into the discussion and I asked him what it was he wanted to do. And he was talking about land banking.
Okay.
I very specifically told him, I said, well, you must have some experience, because land banking is probably the most expensive form of real estate investment, because you don't traditionally have income coming in unless it's a downtown parcel and you're bringing in parking income.
Yeah.
Generally speaking, and even if it's a workable farm.
Yeah.
I mean, you can't generally command more, at least here in Eastern Ontario. It really varies on the type of soil you have.
But
you may get $125 an acre, or you could get $350 an acre.
Yeah.
It depends on the quality of the soil. But that isn't enough to substantiate a purchase of between $12,000 and $18,000 an acre.
Yeah.
So land banking is that ultimately so many people I can't even stop to count have made fortunes land banking.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, you have to have the ability to hold or carry on the land.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's where most major builders, I don't care where you are, anywhere across North America, anywhere, what they'll do is they'll pour a substantial portion of their profits into land. I see builders now that are building a property that they've owned for 20, 25 years.
Yeah.
So it's not a short-term type thing.
No.
Your situation is a little different, but it proves the point. I mean, there's a building on it. You made use of that building, some income, until you could get it to the stage where you could rebuild. So how did that building that existed on it when you bought it, Kwesi?
It was just two retail spaces. We were, 1,500 square feet altogether? Excuse me, 3,000 square feet. It was like, yeah, because our unit was 1,100. It was around 3,000 square feet altogether at the time.
Which is like next to no ground coverage.
Yeah.
Three quarters of an acre.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not even close. You had lots and lots of room. Good for your mom, you know, recognizing and seeing what a great opportunity that was. And obviously. Yeah. So you buy the land.
Yeah.
You're working on the land. Manually, your office is in a building on the land.
Yeah.
Who conceptualized what's being built now? Did you actually take it to a planner and say, what can I build on this? Explain to our listeners how you went about
determining that. So, you know, as you mentioned, obviously my background in commercial real estate sales, and we do quite a bit of apartment building. So I have quite experience in seeing apartment buildings that exist and different designs and what. So the first thing I did speak with the city, find out what within the zoning, you know, what exactly can we do? How high can we go? How wide can we go? Et cetera, et cetera. Then from there, we had a conversation with the architect, say, okay, let's put together a high level site plan on what can be done. And I won't lie, I did go to a few different ones over time just to get different, you know, we started with one and then things slowed down and perspective changed, but all that being said, we got the site plan. Once we had the site plan, that's when I went back to the city, you know, kind of get their comments on it, you know, and see what's happening from there. But it was also during that time that we were doing some of the studies. So the environmental study was then at purchase, but we did the geotechnical study. We did some of the other, started a little bit of the civil work to understand how deep these costs were going to be. And it was good that we did. And I suggest anyone to do your geotechnical early enough, because that's a big determination on if you can do underground parking or not, you know? So that part had started before I linked with my JV partner, and he's already built quite a bit of buildings. So yeah, in one notion, he looked at the geo report and was like, you know what, I think we should scrap the underground parking concept and just focus on going above ground. So we did have, you know, many different iterations. We had a because we could go up to six stories. So we had a six story model where we're going to do parking on the ground floor and then apartments above. We did have a model with the underground parking, but after kind of assessing everything and also it being a sizable project, we said, you know, we want to keep it in a price point that's not going to keep us up at night. And also we tried to do it keep to a piece of the building code where we could do three stories wood without too many complications. And so that's why we ended up keeping it that size. And, you know, I think our architect did a good job of working with that, designing that. The other big factor too was parking. So in Clarence Rockland, there's no public transit. You know what I mean? So the parking had a big factor in how big the building could actually finally be. You know, if this building was in the city of Ottawa, then definitely we could do more. I mean, the city of Ottawa requirements for parking are quite less. Even the Clarence Rockland ones, we did have to get a permission to do a little bit less than what they were offering, but even they agreed that, you know what, I think this building, given the location, given the amount of parking on the street, I feel that it's okay that, you know, and we're only one shy of what they were typically wanted. So it wasn't like a huge, huge swing.
Did they make you go through a minor variance process?
Yeah, we did. Yeah.
So again, listeners, the one thing that you want to keep in mind is that regardless of where you are, underground parking costs more per square foot than the actual construction of the building is.
Yeah.
So there's a huge, while underground parking is nice to have, particularly in situations where parking is and comes at a premium.
Yeah.
In this particular case, as Kwesi pointed out, it wasn't deemed absolutely necessary. And as a consequence of making that decision, development decision, you saved yourself a huge amount of money. So all the numbers kind of come in and work that way. So good for you. Good for you.
Bernie. Yeah, for sure.
Kwesi, congratulations on getting that. A lot of moving parts.
Yeah.
How did you figure, listen, this is a good place and there's enough people to sustain it? Is it the demand that at large, or is it the city saying that versus like, you could have done a mix of residential and office or residential and retail?
Yeah.
What was, like, you know, how did you come down and shake it from, you know, this is the goal and this is what we're ending up today? Because as you go moving forward, like you said, the soil doesn't lend itself well to an underground garage, right? Which could compound things. So how did you get to the end? Like, what was the on-off switches, the go, no-go in the project?
So from a go, no-go perspective, it came down to how we were going to line up our financing. And I'd say that was a big piece of it. We had certainly we're going to go residential because like financing is a big piece of development, right? It's a big piece. And so we understood the financing that was out there. We understood, I guess we'll get into it later, maybe the MLS Select program. We understood that, yes, although I'm on Laurier Street, although, yes, I could do some commercial, I just, like, we looked at it, did look at it quite a bit, but I just didn't feel it was necessary, given also where we are on Laurier Street. Like, where we are, we could do it. But also, the other big thing is, too, when you do commercial, then you need more parking per square foot. So to be able to be as dense as possible and really make things flow and not have to take advantage, not have to give up so much parking, it was best to do residential. So that's how that went. And in terms of the go, no go, it really was a matter of making sure we lined everything up. From the financing funds that we had, would have to bring through to getting kind of pre-qualified with CMHC. Like, we had a good, I have to say we have a good rapport with our contact so we ended up getting it through CMLS. So we had a good rapport with them. And actually with us, there was a grant program that we went after. And so we were in constant contact with CMHC the whole way through.
Great, Moore. I know the plan was to get into it just a little later, but we are right on the topic. So
yeah.
Why don't you tell us about working with CMHC? Because okay. I want to know how you financed it, Kwesi, and I'm sure our listeners would like to too. So how did you finance it? So there you are. You have this property.
Yeah.
Did you pay cash for it? Did you have a mortgage on it to begin with? Tell me from the get-go. Property, how did you buy it?
Okay, so we bought the property originally. Yes, I did have. Now, keep in mind, the purchase price of the property at the time was around like $250,000. Okay, so by the time that we got all our plans together and everything like that, it appraised this again. This is in 2025 or 2024, early 2024. It had appraised at $900,000. So there was good equity growth in being able to sit on it. So we did have a mortgage on it. And so what we had to do, and that was another piece of the play in terms of making the numbers work. So what we had to do, we had to build it in a way where we're going to make sure to create enough equity that we can. So I did still have a smaller mortgage on it. So we create enough equity to be able to take out the mortgage through the construction finance piece of it. So that's how that was taken care of. And then when we received our first draw, well, let me even take one step back, because one thing that people, like, you'll hear from MLS Select that they'll give you the funds to do the project, but you have to make sure they only give it to you after the fact, after you spent the money, right? It has to be ready to go for them. So they know that, okay, we give this money, this thing is getting built. That was always their concern. They want to make sure it's going to be built. So I did end up having to take some private money to pay for some of the soft costs as we went. And it wasn't until we got the first draw that a lot of these things get paid out. And it doesn't even all get paid out at one time. It's only a portion of it that gets paid, percentage of it that gets paid out. But as we go, we get more draws. We work. So essentially, work gets done. Then you get a draw. You pay the consultants and the contractors and workers and stack up just like that. Keep moving that forward that way. Yeah. But so from CMHC perspective, though, I have to say my relationship or our time with them and our experience has been good. Like, they were certainly good, and I don't have any complaints from that perspective. As it relates to the MLI Select, they deal with the bank and the bank deals with us. But as really with that grant program, we were directly with them, and it is a long process for us to be able to get that.
So the grant was actually administered through CMHC rather than the municipality or the province?
Yes. So what was good is because their I guess criteria is more up to date. So the province does have a program where if you offer so many affordable units, then that's where our grant came in. We have a number of affordable units. But the province's threshold was just, in my opinion, just out of line with today. So they basically set what the average rents are for a municipality. And now maybe because Clarence Rockland's a smaller place, they just haven't done the numbers yet, but they had it as basically we would have had to rent our bachelor units like under $600. And 600 is like you can't rent a bedroom for $600 these days.
Rooms,
you
know, downtown are $600.
Yeah, So it was very, it wasn't something that we could go after. But the CMHC program was based on something that was a bit more feasible to the marketplace, and so we were able to go after that.
So you designed and built your building. So that,
well, the building's not built yet, but we designed it.
But your design build concept is based on CMHC criteria in order to facilitate the financing.
So I would say, that program was certainly in mind in the design. So they have certain not only just so in the design, but also the design, like the mechanical system, the plumbing system. Like they have thresholds in terms of how efficient the building has to be. You know, you get certain points for how much amenity space and accessibility that you're offering. So our building is, we call it Chateau 630, Chateau 632, and we're very much tailored to like a 55 plus audience. And one of the reasons I did that, when you talked about the market, so I did own some smaller plex, and actually triplex almost across the street that I purchased in 2015. Okay. So we bought that triplex 2015. I did live in it, actually. That was my home for a while. Renovated the whole thing and got a real good sense of the market locally. Very, very good sense. But what I also noticed, there's only, if I think about it, I could count on one hand how many buildings in town have elevators. I had done a report before coming into the city on the demographics of the area, and the demographics of the 55 plus in this area, like, far outweighs any of the other ones. Now, the lower demographic is catching up because they're starting to build a lot more housing, but there's a deep population of people 55 plus who are going to be looking for a building, and they're going to be looking for something with elevators. And it's come a little bit true, because even the calls that we're getting in on the leasing side, we're getting great calls on people who are excited about the property, who are actually now, who had, I guess, been looking for that, but they're actually talking to us. Okay, we're getting ready to, when should I start thinking about selling my house to be able to get into this thing? So it I think it goes full circle in terms of the marketplace. You know, some of these things would get sold, young people buy the house that, you know, grandma, grandpa sitting in this 3,000 square foot house that they don't need.
Yeah, that's great. Absolutely brilliant. That's great.
I've got some questions now.
Yeah,
crazy.
Sure.
It's awesome.
You have a two-bedroom that he can use.
I'm not getting kicked out of the house here. I'm good. What's the difference between doing rental versus condo? That's kind of the second question. The first question, though, you talked about different financing models, components. And so you got to go to the one person first, and you got to go to the second person, you know, and follow the daisy chain. How do you stack it? And what has, like you kind of mentioned with CMHC, you got to have most of the stuff ready to, you know, flip the switch on and roll. But like for the bank, like when do things have to be in play for you to make it more successful? Or is it a progress activity, like when you're building you're doing progress payments, right? When you're doing a rental, right? You go so far and then trigger. How did you handle that from the financial perspective? How did you shape that?
So did you approach the bank first or CMHC first?
Okay. So with us and the grant program existing, here's what's interesting. The grant program that I was after was one particular program, but what was like unfortunate and almost like, so I do this thing on my Instagram called Journey to 150, and we go through it. But all that said, there was a specific program with a specific amount of money that was tailored to it. And we had started this, like, even, I think it was April 2024. And then we were in contact with them. And, you know, we had a person who was, she was talking with us and giving da-da-da-da-da. But so we would submit and they say, no, we want more stuff. We want it to be further along. So then we'd submit and we want more stuff, but it needs to be further along. And then we would submit and they say, we want you to have, the bank lined up. So we got things lined up with the bank further along. And then when we finally got to the point where they thought they had everything, they said all the money was gone. So we spent all that time. Yeah, they said we spent all that time working on that particular grant program. And when we started, she said, yeah, there's lots of money there. And then by the time we actually saw all the money's gone. So
who are you applying for the grant with?
It was through CMHC.
Oh, it was?
Yeah, yeah. It was a program through CMHC.
All right, okay.
And to make a long story short, fortunately, what they ended up And I think it's because we went in early. And I would say that to anyone, try and get in, like, at least have some kind of talk and rapport as early as possible, because I think that rapport that we built with them, and they saw the project, they saw the value of the project. I don't think they had done any type of these grants or had seen many projects in our area. So I think that lent a hand to it. Actually, we even got some support from a lot of the local organizations in town as well. Like, they had written some letters for us saying, yes, there's a deep demand for housing in the area. Please, consider these guys for the application. So I think that certainly worked in our favor. So ultimately, they did come up with something for us, but it was a fraction of what we were anticipating. But that being said, it was still okay, because we bought the land early enough. We had enough equity in there, and we had done our performas in a way that we had done the performa in a way that we felt we could still make it work, and so we still went forward with it.
Condo versus rental. Is one side of the coin better than the other, or?
I think it depends on what your vision is. I think it depends on where things are set in the market. Now, I think if you could remember, like, the condo market at the time when we were starting was very, people talk about the condo market, but the condo market at the time, there was, I guess, a lot of movement in it, and rental was the biggest thing. Now, we're in the rental business, so that's really where it came for us. We'd always been in that rental business. The vision for myself when I looked at it, and like, I do business with my mom as well, our vision was to be able to purchase a certain amount of rental properties. So it was always going to be rental for, well, I can't say it was always going to be, because markets change, things change. If you have to pivot, you have to pivot. But our vision for the most part was to do rental. Now, there was the concept, slightly of a concept in the beginning, thinking, okay, well, if we do, we can do it as rental, but we can condominiumize it in the beginning. And so that way, if we want to sell it as condos later, we can do that. We opted not to do that, though, mostly because when you design a building to be a condo properly, it's going to be a little bit different than being a rental building. Okay. There's a lot of people who do, you'll have condos and people who rent condos, but it can be a different feel in that building than it can be in a rental building. So rental was certainly the focus and direction that we were taking. But going forward, I'd say this, going forward, where the marketplace is now, I know they're saying there's a lot of condos. I wouldn't be against condos because of this experience I've had with this. I wouldn't be against doing a condo. But rental is still the focus as long as there's enough demand in the market
really,
to fill the
units. You're really playing to the right market, too. I mean, condominiums really haven't been the rage for quite some time. The only benefit to a condominium is, or has been, that it's a good entry point for a first-time home buyer only because of the cost.
Yeah.
From a long-term basis, all market trends and all studies that I've read, and as a matter of fact, everything that I've read is pointing towards the rental market is being strong for the next several decades.
Yeah.
Not months, not years. Decades. And that's one reason why these huge real estate funds, REITs and otherwise, but these huge private real estate funds are buying complete tracts of subdivisions. Yeah. You don't see it here in Canada like you do in the States.
Yeah.
In the States, it's happened time and time again where a major player has stepped in when a development is announced and said, you know what? If they haven't aren't providing financing or actually doing the build themselves,
yeah,
isn't their thing. But what is their thing is holding on to rental units and rental accommodation. They're eyeing that as the place to be for the long term. So they're going into major developers and saying, yeah, you're building a 250 unit subdivision here. We are going to buy the whole thing from you. That's what's happening. Why? Because it looked at a stable, and it's something that, it goes back to what your grandmother was saying. If you have land, you'll always be wealthy. At the end of the day, everyone needs a place to stay.
Exactly. Everyone
needs a home.
Exactly.
And part of the issue is, as Bernie, you and I have discussed this ad nauseum, has to do with the fact that more and more people are having difficulty getting into the marketplace. So what do you do if you can't buy? You rent.
Yeah.
Period.
But I think there's two sides to it too, because I mean I know people always, certainly a lot of times, are looking at that portion. You know, if you can't buy, you rent. But I think the renting is also a lifestyle. You know, I think it's certain people get to a point where necessarily, you know what, I don't really care to cut the grass. I don't want to have to deal with the maintenance of the roof. I don't have to deal with this. I don't have to deal with that. I just want a place. And, you know, especially as people get older and they're traveling more, you know, what, I have my place. I'm here. You know, the landlord takes care of everything. I got some friends next door. You know, because a lot of times, too, like, I mean, some of these calls we get, people are, you know, one of their significant other has passed away. You know, their kids are looking and they're truly just there by themselves. At least if they're in the building, there's some other people to talk to. But even if not even thinking about a 55 plus, even as a young person, I mean, if I'm in a rental building, there's, you know, I'm in a rental building, the building has amenities, the building's in the location I want it to be, everything is new, I don't have to worry about this, that, the third. There's other ways that they can, you know, use their money to still get a return. Of course, I think if you're going to be in a home for, like, you know, 35 years or whatever, you know, you're going to build your family here, you have your job here, yes, having a house is certainly ideal. But sometimes it gets to a point where might not need to own the house anymore. You know, it could take equity out, have it go to work, and have more of a free flowing lifestyle.
Yeah, absolutely. That's so true. And it's something that I'm part of that age group where, you know, right now my wife and I are having, you know, constant discussions about that.
Yeah.
About, like, okay, what's the next? Look, we've lived in our home for 40 plus years. We've been here a long time.
Yeah.
But the discussion is still there.
Yeah.
Like, is this what we want to do? I mean, we're still relatively young, but,
yeah,
you know, is this the lifestyle that we want? I mean, if we're having that discussion, and I know amongst my acquaintances and cohorts and friends, you know, that's a discussion as you get older and older, you're going to have more, not just with yourself, but with your significant other.
Yeah. Bert,
wow, I was enjoying the whole string here.
Enter.
No. So, building the project, getting it all kind of wrapped up. How did you pick the contractor? Like, you know, is best price? Is it past experience? What were your keys, and how did you maintain quality control?
So it wasn't just a price thing for us. It certainly was experience and, like, the relationship that we kind of had with them and built with them. So it's because we got pricing, interestingly enough. I had some very, very low pricing, and then I had some pricing that was quite a bit higher than what I thought it was going to be, and then we had some in the middle. And so it really came to, like, the group that we picked. I think I don't want to necessarily say lucked out, but I think we certainly picked right, because it's interesting, because we were leaning a different way, but they made it a point to make sure to keep calling me. You know, and you know, not just to ask for the business, but to talk about what they could do. And they're always showing, you know, this is this angle, this is that angle, da 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 da. And but what was big was that they had recently done, like, of all the ones we looked at, they had all recently done some apartment buildings. And so that was a huge criteria. We wanted to make sure it was not just any type of home builder, because, I mean, technically, at this size, at this type of building, only being three stores within that part of the building code, person who built a house can legally build this, but we wanted someone who had the experience. We wanted someone who was also with CMHC. Sometimes you have to be bonded, so we needed to make sure they were familiar with the bond process. And but also, these guys, they understand the investment background of it. I mean, they really do. I mean, there's anyway, we have a good rapport with them, and we've been quite happy so far.
We know, Bernie, you know what we say about experience. Experience is
the best teacher or the best voice.
I mean, theory is one thing, and willingness is another thing, but experience is the biggest thing, because this is for myself. I mean, it's the first project of this kind of size for my business partner. It's a smaller project for him. So for me and him, it works out well. But from the contractor's perspective, you know, I wasn't willing to take a gamble on someone who hasn't, who could look at this and just say, this is a walk in the park. You know what I mean? Just, you know, give us the plans and kind of go forward. So
you know, we could talk with you for hours, obviously, but what advice would you have for anyone contemplating a similar type project?
I would say don't be afraid to do joint ventures. Like, opening the door to a joint venture, I think, was the biggest catalyst in making sure to move this forward. Because, I mean, in the beginning, I was really hoping to do it myself, but the fact of the matter is, you know, in business is a team sport. And that's what you are doing. You are, it's a building, but it, you know, you're running a business. So business is a team sport. So don't be afraid to bring in someone who has a little bit of the knowledge that you might be lacking on, or you don't have enough on. It's also nice to have a, you know, a partner. If there's some surprise costs and they have some extra cash that they could come in with too. So that's certainly assistance. But I would say, like, it's funny because I have a client, as I mentioned, obviously we sell apartment buildings as well. And I have a client, they're looking at a pre-sized property that they have purchased. And I think you got to build for your site, but also build within your means. So, I mean, it's funny, originally they had a particular design on the site. And I was like, you know what, if you were just to tweak this design differently, we would actually be able to save here, here, and here, and here. And so those exercises are definitely something to do, because, and that's also, again, the difference between hiring your person who's done multiple apartment buildings and your architect who's designed multiple parts to hiring the person who maybe typically does a house and saying, you know, we can do this, and the architect, you know, we can do this and make it super jazzy and this, that, and the other, and it goes off the grid. But you got to remember where you sit. You know, you got to remember, you know, what you can truly get per square foot. You got to understand what is actually the best way to run a rental building.
So that, like most things in life, proves the point that experience is the
best teacher,
the better teacher.
Okay, I don't know what's up with you today, Bernie, but anyways, so you want to take us home, Bernie?
Sure. Kwesi, all kidding aside, and all the experience that you've had and all the things you've been taught, what are you working on now?
So now the big thing is to, one, I want to finish the building, because, you know, it's not just about the construction. So when you look at these things, people see the construction part, they think of the development, but the development is like the whole process from the land acquisitions to the consulting to the, we got to finish the building, make sure it's done on time, on budget. Then we got to make sure the lease up goes properly and get it filled. So from that point of view, that's this project taking it to the end. We're hoping to be finished November 2026. We have already pre-leased some units, which has been good. So we want to make sure we get at least on time and get everyone in. So that's, I'd say, the biggest focus. But the next building, so like I mentioned, my mom has that property on 10th Line. And so that's very much our next focus. So that would be the next one. I mean, the cons, and that'll be a bigger building as well, because the land size is quite bigger. So it was great. So this is, we do this one, gives us the great experience. Well, I'm sure there'll be, although so, you know, so far there's maybe not many, but maybe some minor things I might have done differently, minor things. But honestly, I'm very happy with how it's going so far. But the idea is to have this experience so we can move on to the next one and do a quite sizable project. And of course, we're still, so, you know, assisting our clients who are also looking at buying other buildings and other pieces of land. Because fact of the matter, you can't do everything. You know, you can't be involved in everything. You can't buy everything. So
what's your exit strategy on this project? Are you just going to hold?
Yeah, our plan is to hold the project. Now, if we had to, we could sell it. But our plan is to hold it. We're looking to be a long-term holders on this. I mean, myself, my business partner, we've had the same mindset. Funny enough, my business partner, we actually, it's a bit unique, actually. So we've known each other actually since high school, this particular partner. And but I didn't know, and we've kept in touch, and I'd actually, you know, his father was actually a client of ours, and I'd done sold buildings for him. And it wasn't until like only a little bit later that I found out he had all these other projects that he was doing too. So it was an interesting turns of events.
That's great. What a history. Yeah. So thank you, Kwesi. We finish up with some rapid fire questions, just okay, so the audience can get to know you a little better.
Okay.
Crazy. What are you into reading wise? Are you into novels, fantasy?
For me, it's always been some sort of like education or something with a purpose behind it. I've never been one to, although my parents didn't like it, but I've never been into just reading a book. Like, my sister's into Harry Potter, but I never could have got into that or anything like that. So yeah, good. I like to read books that are going to help. I don't know if you call them self-help or improvement books or educational books or whatever you want to call them, but that's always been the types of things that I'd like to read.
So do you have a favorite book?
I don't know that I can say I have a favorite book. I can say, so recently, it's funny, I read Think and Grow Rich long, you know, it's a long time ago, and I recently reread that book, which was interesting. So I reread that book, and so that was really interesting. And then they had the, what's that other, the power of that Tony Robbins book, The Unlimited Power. I read that one again too, some time ago. And then there's a lot of some different small books too that I like, that I've been reading, some stuff specifically on real estate, as you know, from the real estate agent business to a development business to business and just business in general. So those are the types of things.
Self-improvement books. Bernie,
You have a favorite meal? Is there something that going, that's your go-to sustenance?
Whatever my significant other's going to cook for me.
Good answer. Safe answer.
Do you have a dish that your dear mama used to make for you that you really enjoy?
Yeah. No, she. I mean, my mom. So we're from Ghana in West Africa. So jollof.
Are you really?
Yeah. You didn't know that?
I made reference to that earlier on in the podcast. I didn't realize it. Isn't that funny? Okay. All right. Go ahead.
Yeah. No. Yeah. So my mom will make jollof rice. So that's what we'll have with whatever, with chicken or with some vegetables or something like that. So yeah, I'd certainly say that's always nice when I go home to have that.
So do you have a favorite alcoholic beverage or wine?
So I'm not the biggest beer guy. What I do have beer. Like, it's funny, in town there's a couple of. So funny enough, so I live like almost down the street from this particular, from the building we're building. So it's unique to me. And in town, there's a couple of breweries. So when it comes to beer, I do like to go to the actual breweries and get something that's local, that's unique that way. Whether it's supporting, it's a different taste of, I'm into that. I don't, you know, you go to the bar today, you got to spend so much to get only so far. So it's a different experience. But I do like so when it comes to beer, I get that. But I'm not the biggest beer guy. Honestly, I'll have wine, but my go-to drink, I'd say, as simple as it is, it would be like a rum and Coke.
There you go.
Yeah.
What's a perfect day look like for you?
So every day, I'll say this, every day, more or less every day, we wake up at around 4:30 and then we go to the gym. And so that's how every day starts, except for Monday. Monday is my off day. And then every other day I'm in the gym. There might be one other day if, you know, something happening, we'll take it up. But every day pretty much always starts in the gym, whether I'm lifting or running or doing something, it always starts in the gym. And then from there, you want to be able to get, I like to do my mornings a certain way, have my afternoons a certain way, and have the evenings hopefully finished in a perfect world by 6 or 7. And then I'll be relaxing for the rest of the evening.
Brilliant. So where's your favorite place in the world to visit?
My favorite place in the world to visit. I don't know if I've been there yet, so it's tough to say. So I'll say of the places that I've been, I'd say places with water. I like to relax in the water if I can, definitely. You know, I'm looking forward to going back to Ghana soon if I hopefully have that opportunity. And, you know, home is a nice place to be too when there's peace of mind.
Absolutely.
Just to wrap us up, what's your favorite type of ice cream? Or is it ice cream that is your favorite dessert?
Not a big ice cream person, interesting enough, you know.
I'll certainly
have ice cream, if, you know, like I'll have a chocolate, but what I actually have more, which this might be weird, I'll have like, so I'll have cottage cheese and then I'll put chocolate chips in it and then I'll have that. That'll be like my ice cream.
Okay. All right. That's not bad.
You might want to try, there's a akin to cottage cheese is called quark.
Quark. Okay.
And it's, you take plum jam and you mix it in there.
Okay.
It'll give you, by itself, it's too banal, but you add the plum and it's perfect. It's just the both blending gives you kind of a nice flavor.
And what's that called, Bernie?
Quark. Q-U-A-R-K. It's kind of like a yogurt cottage cheese mix. Has consistency of cottage cheese, except it's solid, not chunky. And you put it on a toast.
Yeah. My mother used to make us, I'm Hungarian. And nice. My mother used to make, like, she used to take egg noodles and mix in cottage cheese and a little bit of cinnamon. And that was like a great dessert. If my memory serves me correct, it was really something else. So, Kwesi, thank you so much for being our guest today. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Oh, thank you for having me.
You're a very knowledgeable, you know, young man. You know your craft. And we here at the Property Wizard, we're very, very happy to have you agree and to be a guest on our show. So thank you. I'm sure there's going to be all sorts of questions for you. So what's the best way for someone to get a hold of you?
Probably by email. So you could send me an email, kborn@klbinvesting.ca. But feel free to reach out on the social platforms as well. If you're on LinkedIn, if someone would send me a message, Kwesi L. Born, you can certainly send me a message there. I am on Instagram and Facebook as well, but LinkedIn's probably the most active for me.
Perfect. Brilliant. Anything to add, Bernie?
Well, Fred, I feel even more enlightened understanding how a project comes together, because we've talked in the past about, you know, doing the ground study, you know, the environmental studies, that whole nine yards, but, you know, actually watching the moving parts, living and breathing, coming together, you know, everything from the financing to finding the right contractor. Really enlightening. Enjoyed that.
Yeah, it was great to have someone.
No, I was just going to say, I mean, I'm glad you got that out of it. And I encourage anyone, I don't know if you're an Instagram guy, but if you go on my Instagram page, yeah, we're posting kind of, I wouldn't say daily, but quite a bit of updates in terms of where we're at with the process. Like, I'm really trying to chronologically, like, really go through the whole journey. So it'd be interesting when it's all finished.
Brilliant. It was really nice to have someone on that kind of wrapped it all up, you know, from the start to, you know, making the go, no go decision to the process.
Yeah.
We're looking forward to having you back on, and you can discuss when you gave your first tenant the first key.
Yeah, sure.
Wonderful. Okay, so thank you, listeners. We've got a full slate of new and really enlightening podcasts for you for season 5. Again, thank you for tuning in. And remember, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities. But add in there, Fred, you have something out there now that's another source of information called the PropertyWise newsletter. How does that work?
Brilliant. Just visit our page, sign up. It's a free newsletter in it. It's issued every month. You'll garner all sorts of investment tips, all sorts of real estate insight, and you'll be directed to our latest podcasts and some interesting projects and properties that we have on the market as well. No cost. Visit the website, sign up. You'll get it every month without fail.
And to reach Fred, it's at info@gentryres.com. That's info@gentryres.com.
Thank you, listeners, for tuning in once again. And remember, if there are no problems,
there are no opportunities.
Thanks for listening to Fred and Bernie on another edition of The Property Wizard, brought to you by Creative Insight, helping you connect, and Gentry Learning, real estate professionals and educators. Got a question? Ready to invest? Email info@gentryres.com. And if you'd like to find out more about the courses offered through Gentry Learning, visit gentrylearning.com. Remember to like and leave us a comment and subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode of The Property Wizard.